It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Tomorrow is the 4th of July, the annual holiday in which we celebrate the founding of the United States. Most of us learn many of the details of our nation's founding in our history classes, from the Articles of Confederation to the Continental Congress, the Declaration of Independence, and battles such as Valley Forge and Yorktown. But while we might think we know about our founding fathers, there are large parts of their lives that aren't found in many of our history textbooks.
Writer and Wisconsin native Peter Stark knew what we all knew about George Washington. Stark's writing specialties are adventure and history, and during some time in the relatively wild reaches of western Pennsylvania, he discovered it was a place that a young George Washington had some experiences that informed the leader he became. Stark set out to learn more, and the result is his new book, Young Washington. He joins us in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Mitch.
Most of us probably have this image of George Washington as being kind of from this, you know, lauded, noble English family. But from what you write, that really does not seem to be the case. So what was George Washington's upbringing like and his ancestry?
He has a really interesting ancestral background. Basically, the short version is that the Washington family had been trying to climb to the upper echelons of the aristocracy for centuries, first in England and then in Virginia. And with remarkable consistency, they had not made it. The Washington men tended to marry wealthy landed widows. The men would rise in status to gentleman status. They'd have like 18 children. The wealth would disperse and they'd kind of sink back down. George Washington's great-grandfather essentially got shipwrecked in Virginia on a trading venture. Married a magistrate's daughter. Magistrate gave him 700 acres of land, you know, so here's the wealthy, fortuitous marriage. And that established the Washingtons. And so for the next four generations until George was born in 1732, they were tobacco planters at kind of middling level. And George was very ambitious to climb out of that.
That was really what sets George apart, is his ambition.
Incredible ambition. It's very notable from the time he's a teenager. And one of the things I've felt about in all my exposure to this part of his life is that his father died when he was 11, and his older brother, whom he revered, died when he was in late teens, and he was never very close to his mother. And I've thought that if his father hadn't died so young, he would have been more anchored in the world, more sure of himself, really. And so, but he was so determined to make a name for himself.
Well, and so well before he is a founding father, he is a surveyor. There is a lot of land out there with which to survey. But give us a sense for, you know, what the role of surveyors was in, you know, the 1740s and 50s.
Well, you can imagine that in the 1740s and 50s, that's basically 100 years after the Jamestown landings, a little more than that. And the British population was still very much confined to the Atlantic coast. Yet there was a huge stretch of land that lay just over the Appalachian Mountains and the Appalachian foothills and over the mountains. And George started surveying that as a teenager. So he developed very early almost a lust for land. All these Virginia planters were very much about land. And he had a real sense of acquisition for land.
Well, so from that, what is the turn of events that leads to his journey, you know, well to the Northwest to deliver a message to the French commandant in what I guess is now probably the area around Erie, Pennsylvania?
Right. And so, George, you know, when we think of coastal the Atlantic and coastal Virginia, so that's where the British colonies are, of course, the colonies that we know. And then up in Canada, there were the French, and they had, you know, their colony there that dated back to the early 1600s also. So in between was a huge area known as the Ohio wilderness. And it's not just the Ohio we think of today, not the state. It would encompass Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Virginia, on and on and on. It's an area almost the size of France. So in the about 1753, George had just as a 21-year-old, signed up to be a young officer in the Virginia militia as another way to advance his standing and his career. And he was still surveying. And he had, was doing a little planting. And he signed up for this job and this post. And at that point, just then, the British governor of Virginia, Virginia Colony, of course, Governor Dinwiddie, heard that the French were building forts out in the vast Ohio wilderness. And Governor Dinwiddie needed someone to deliver a message to the French, basically saying, stay out, all these lands belong to King George. George Washington raised his hand. He had some frontier experience. Governor Dinwiddie dispatched him and sent him over the Appalachian Mountains in late 1753 with a wilderness guide, Christopher Gist. They hit terrible snowstorms crossing the mountains. They were on horseback. They had servants. They got way back into the wilderness after a terrible journey, and they came to a French post. It was greeted by a French officer who said, oh, man, you're in the wrong place. It kind of brushed George off. And remember, George is only 21 years old, and he has no military experience. Very ambitious. And brushes him off, says, oh, you got to ride a week that way to my boss. And so George and Gist and their party do, and through, you know, swamps and mud and rain and snow and on, and get to a larger French post recently built. And there is a distinguished gentleman, elderly gentleman soldier, French commandant, who greets George with, you know, the formal dinner and candlelight and red wine, which is imported from France, and wonderful meats, and the whole formal greeting, and then reads the letter and goes into another room and writes a reply and sends George off. And George goes thrashing back through the wilderness at high speed because Governor Dinwiddie has told him to go with all urgency. And George ends up leaving his horses, which are failing because they can't find enough feed in the snow and the streams are frozen, and he almost dies falling off a raft into a river and all these incredible harrowing adventures. It's amazing he made it. And he gets back to Governor Dinwiddie and hands him the letter. And the letter says from the French commandant, well, our nations are finally at peace. You know, this is after they've been at war for 700 years. And I would very much like to keep the peace. However, as to your request that I should leave, I don't think so. And that's where the real trouble begins.
Well, and what's interesting, a lot of it is interesting, but, you know, of all the people to take on this mission, this is a guy that, you know, he had some frontier experience, but he was not a wilderness expert.
He was not. No.
Not a diplomacy expert either.
Neither of those things. I mean, George starts whining when he first goes into the wilderness that there are no linen tablecloths on the tables of the frontier settlers in their log cabins, and their table manners are terrible. They just eat with a knife, and their bed bugs, and blah, blah, blah. So he has, you know, he's learning. And so he has at first very little wilderness experience and no military experience, and that really gets him into a great deal of trouble when Governor Dinwiddie, having read this letter, sends him back into the wilderness at the head of a small military party and to essentially deliver a firmer message to the French. And Governor Dinwiddie warns George, do not be the aggressor and be cautious. George, in his naked ambition, proceeds to do exactly the opposite. He ends up ambushing a small party of French who are having breakfast in a wooded glen on a rainy dawn, and George and his men open fire, and they end up killing a number of these French. George takes the rest of the French prisoner, about 20, 25 prisoners, and you'd think at this point a sensible commander would pause, that this did not go exactly as planned. But George doesn't. He just brazenly pushes ahead, and he's very cocky. He says, well, if the French can put up no more fight than this, I'll drive them back to damn Montreal. And he writes to his brother, I mean, really right after this terrible incident, he writes to his brother and says, I heard bullets whistling, and believe me, there's something charming in the sound. And eventually that got back to King George, who responded, he would not say so if he'd heard many. But what happens is that George ends up getting essentially slaughtered by the French and the Indians and has to surrender, and terrible experience. And this is what touches off the French and Indian War.
How does the transformation take place then from this cocky guy who really, you know, believes a lot in himself without necessarily having the wisdom and the experience to back it up, to a guy who really does come up with the gravitas that one needs to become the commander of the Continental Army?
You know, it's a great question and a really interesting transformation. There are several key moments and events, and the patterns that I see is that he first, instead of being so self-promoting, just remarkably self-promoting and ambitious and whiny and petulant, complaining about officers who are ranked above him and not enough pay, and he's underappreciated and he's going to quit. He threatens to quit seven times and quits some of them. It goes on and on like that. But he eventually gets put in charge of the Virginia regiment, almost 1,000 men at age 23, very young. And he's responsible for protecting these frontier settlers over a 350-mile-long frontier, which I compare to the Afghanistan-Pakistan frontier of today, an almost impossible task to defend. Through this process, he sees his own men get slaughtered and lying dead in mud and blood in trenches. And, you know, these guys who are his age, who he's been responsible for, he's marched them into this situation, and now they're lying dead all around him. And you see George's sense of empathy start to grow, first towards the men he's leading. And he's also very good about at a certain point, he shifts over and he literally at one point gets down off his horse. And, you know, that's a big thing for a Virginia gentleman to do. And he starts, you know, kind of getting down in the mud and pushing cannons up mountainsides with his men. And, you know, really, he really gets down there in the dirt with them, which is they really bond with that. And then there's no sense no doubt that he has whatsoever, that he has this incredible bravery. You know, he is utterly fearless. No one ever doubted that about him from the very beginning. And incredibly fortunate at the same time for what he survives. So at one point the British finally do send a big army of redcoats into the wilderness under General Braddock, it's a famous incident in colonial history. They get ambushed by the Indians and the French. They don't even see the Indians. You know, they're behind trees and they just drop like flies in the middle of the road.
Traditional rules of engagement not applying.
The general is marching along saying, well, there's, you know, and the officers are saying, well, we can't have a battle here. There's no place to have a battle. So why would we worry? And of course, the Indians, that's what they do. They fight in that terrain, and it's just again terrible slaughter of hundreds and hundreds. And George is kind of the last officer standing. It's called Braddock's Defeat, this famous battle. And he's a young aide-de-camp to General Braddock, and he rides around delivering messages from the general who's wounded, and George has horses shot out from under him. And then at the end of the battle, he looks at his hat and his coat, and he has four bullet holes through his hat and his coat. And he immediately, again, you know, his response to that is he writes a letter to his brother and says, "Divine providence protected me beyond all human expectation." And at that moment, you know, through that event, one really gets a sense that George starts seeing a larger role for himself, that he's being protected for a reason. And then I think the final thing that's really marked to me is that when he finally does leave the wilderness at age 26, and the British finally pry the French and Indians out of there, George immediately quits. He wants to go back to being a planter. He quits. Within a few weeks of leaving the wilderness, he marries Martha, who's what else? The richest widow in Virginia, who has 17,000 acres of land and dozens and dozens and dozens of slaves, which, you know, of course, is a form of wealth in that those days, that society. And his marriage to Martha instantly brings him up to the top of the Virginia aristocracy. So he doesn't have to worry about his social status anymore. He doesn't really have to worry so much about money. And then I think even more important that Martha gives him this sense of emotional reassurance, and that which he didn't have growing up as a younger man, as an adolescent, as a youth, and George kind of settles down. He becomes a planter for almost 15 years. And then, then we get into the story that we know is that this French and Indian War, which is spread around the globe, known as the Seven Years' War, which started right with George Washington's musket and orders right there. This war finally ends in 1763. 2 years later, in 1765, the British say, "We spent so much money protecting you American colonists. We're feeling really broke, so we're going to put this tax on you guys, the Stamp Act." It causes huge uproar in the colonies, and then the British revoke it, but they add more taxes later, and, we know the story from there. Meanwhile, George is Virginia planter, prosperous, and he's a Virginia, like a legislator. And when things really start heating up, there are the Continental Congresses, and George is a representative from Virginia, one of several. And he goes to the Continental Congress held in May and June of 1775, right after the battles of Lincoln and Concord. The Continental Congress is putting together an army to march against the British in Boston. And they look around the room there in Philadelphia and say, "Who's going to lead this thing?" And, you got short John Adams there and like a lawyer, a mouthy lawyer from Boston. And he's not a wilderness guy.
Not really a recipe for success, no.
And people look around the room and there's this quiet, tall guy who carries himself with a sort of regal bearing, who knew the gift of silence. And George has always had a thing for uniforms. So he's recently designed a new officer's uniform for the county militia down in Fairfax County. And George at the Continental Congress is sitting there silently with this regal bearing and wearing this incredibly beautiful officer's uniform with all the gewgaws and spangles and braids. And people look over and say, "There's our guy." So unanimously, they choose him to be our first commander in chief.
And amazing to think of this guy who was petulant and threatened to quit seven times as being the same guy who in whatever it was, the 1790s, steps down from the presidency for the good of the country.
Exactly. And I think, that this image that we have of George Washington, that I think it's actually done – the image that we've propagated in history, I think it's really done a big disservice to Americans and especially younger Americans, that we have this sense of this, guy who's born, selfless, faultless judgment, flawless, it's sort of an immaculately conceived man-god who arrives on the scene and he leads, the colonies to independence and becomes the first president. And that's not the way it happened at all. I mean, he thrashed and he struggled and he made mistakes and he failed, but he learned from them. And so this more vulnerable, more accessible George Washington is one that I find far more inspirational than this distant statue that we have. And I also think it's a real example both for youth and, we talk about today, in our country, in our Congress, worldwide, enormous crisis of leadership. And here's an example of someone who started out very flawed and he worked at it, he overcame it, and he became this great, and he was this selfless leader who stepped down saying, I don't want to be king. I just want to make this country work. And then he stepped down.
One of those cases where the true story is actually far more interesting and far better than the myth.
It's true, yes. I think exactly that the true story, it has so much more of a human component, and it's one that I think that we as flawed mortal citizens with all our weaknesses can relate to a lot better than this guy who just strides on the scene and magically leads things to this incredible place.
Peter Stark, it's a great story, and you tell it so well. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Mitch. It's been really fun.
Peter Stark's latest book is called Young Washington, How Wilderness and War Forged America's Founding Father. Stark grew up around Pine Lake in Waukesha County, but now calls Montana home.
You can hear more interviews like this one by visiting the Lake Effect page at WUWM.com. One last time.